No, she's got to go back sometime, except for the first even went back. The experience was for the
introductions. We will begin then on the subject of treatment of minorities in Christianity and Islam. And I would just ask perhaps Christian side or the Christian viewpoint or perspective. So we can begin with that.
When I first proposed that I was going to talk about the issue of my arm, I agreed because the person who told me about it knew I had written a paper called Christians in a Muslim State, the Recent Egyptian Debate. And so I thought I was going to talk about the role of Christian minorities in a Muslim state.
That's why you got to sit on that side.
That's right. Then I found out just recently from Mr. Al-Ghazali that I was supposed to talk about the Christian side. And since I am really better conversant with the Muslim side, I decided I'll do both. I hope you don't mind. My idea, and it's something that I just thought about for this, is to look at the fact that both religions are missionary religions. And both religions have scriptural passages and a historical tradition of being sort of commanded to preach and convert people. For example, in the Christian church, we have, especially in the conservative church, I mean, nobody can speak for all Christianity, but the verse from Matthew 28, verses 19 and 20, which says, "Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded, and lo, I am with you always to the close of the age." That verse, and the one that says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life," has sort of focused on the idea that only Christians are going to be saved. Now, there is also in Islam parallel verses. For example, you have whoever seeks a religion other than Islam, it will not be accepted from them. And so both religions have an idea that they are an exclusively chosen people or selected people or whatever we want to call them. And both of them therefore think that anybody who is not a member of that faith community is delinquent, is an apostate. I mean, it depends. And throughout history we have had different reactions culminating from massacres. On the other hand, we have other verses, both in the Quran and in the Bible, which give us a more open and accepting perspective. For example, recently there were some fatwas talking about the verse in the Quran that talks about we have created you nations that you may know one another and compete in righteousness. And so there is a pluralistic view of the world in which Christianity and Islam and Judaism and maybe some other religions may coexist, but the competition is not in trying to convert each other, rather it is on who can be a more righteous person. At least that was one of the interpretations in this fatwa. In the Christian tradition, we have, of course, in the Bible, the verse about, my father's house are many mansions. And the whole idea is that there are other ways of coming to God besides Christ. And even as I say that, I can hear some Christians say, "Well, no, you can't do that." But the question is that there are two possibilities of interpretation in both faiths, both in the scripture and also in the traditions. And in this paper that I read, I became fully aware of the fact that both groups within Islam today were arguing against each other about this world perspective. Is the world a pluralistic world or a dualistic world in which there are Muslims and non-Muslims? And if there are non-Muslims, then there are restrictions on them. And you can see that, for example, in my classes, sometimes I get some quote-unquote fundamentalist Christians, and they always ask, why is it that we allow Muslims to build mosques in the United States when Saudi Arabia does not allow churches to be built there? And so there are people on both sides who are, in a sense, aware of some of the limitations on minorities in both communities. And I did find out that some of the teachings of Maududi that are increasingly being quoted by some people, in which he says that Muslims will not allow any non-Muslims to participate because it is in a sense, the Islamic State is an ideological state. It cannot be provide consultation for government. They cannot be in this or that. And consequently, there are a lot of people who are upset about that. And then on the other hand, if you take the American scene, you will see that there are people who are beginning to be worried about the presence of Muslims. And in the recent situation after the bombing of the World Trade Center, I spent hours talking to reporters who kept saying, well, the Muslims have a different worldview. Once they take over, they're going to force Islam on all of us. Then they are going to make you, you cannot drive. And what are you going to do about this? And I've spent hours trying to explain Islam to them. And one of them said, they don't share our values, and therefore we will be unable to live with them. And so that what I'm saying is that what I would like the discussion to focus on is the reality that we accept the fact that we do have at least two traditions and the scriptural historical interpretations that are necessarily contradictory. And the question that both the Muslim community in the U.S. faces is, which are they going to use? Because I've had people call me and say they are scared that the United States is going to put Muslims in concentration camps. And the question is, Christians of America, become so obsessed with quote-unquote this demon Islam that's about to take over the world, will they accept that Islamism is the next ism or the next evil empire? That is one question that is being raised. Then there is the other part of Western society, which is very open, very accepting, which says that, you can have your religion, you can wear anything you want, and so on and so forth. And the question is how far it goes. And on the other hand, you have people in the Middle East asking questions. If an Islamic State comes into existence, are they going to follow Maududi's teachings? Or are they going to follow somebody else's teaching? How can we tell which tradition is going to dominate once one group comes into power? I think I'll stop here. We'll see if other people want to make comments.
Dale, would you like to?
Sure. I will perhaps come at this question in a slightly different, but I hope complementary way with Yvonne's presentation. I should explain that, that part of my role as I work with the National Council of Churches is that I feel, to use the terminology, somewhat dualistic myself, in that I am a part here in the United States of a majority culture, Christianity being certainly a majority religion in this country. And yet my position with the National Council brings me into contact with Christians in the Middle East who are definitely part of a minority. So that that bifurcated existence makes life a bit complicated. But I want to expand on that theme of majority and minority, which I understand to be of major concern in this segment, to talk about both the United States and the Middle East out of that background, if I might. First of all, if we start with the United States, I think that what we have witnessed, as Yvonne said, is a progressive demonization of Islam, which has had its impact upon Muslims here in this country. And I don't need to tell Muslims that. You know it. You see your religion defamed. You see your loyalty questioned. You see all kinds of unflattering images. You see Islam and Muslim attached to almost inevitably negative connotations. That is part of not the human rights question. It goes beyond the human rights question. It goes beyond legality. It has to do with the environment in which people live in this country. And I'm going to advance quite boldly the proposition that it is the obligation, it is the responsibility of the churches to combat those images. I didn't expect applause, but it's appreciated. I think we have tried to do that, but not very well. And the evidence of the fact that we haven't done it very well is around us. There is this new wave. We need to respond in a much more direct way to this challenge to our pluralism in this country. It is not out of charity to Islam that the churches ought to be doing this. It is out of faithfulness to Christianity that we ought to be doing this. So that's point number one. The majority, the responsibility of the churches in a majority culture. But point number two, and this is the harder one to say. As I said, my position brings me into contact with Christians in the Middle East who are in the minority and who have certain anxieties. One of their anxieties is, in fact, the very process of dialogue that Western Christians are eager to have with Middle Eastern Muslims because they feel that this is power speaking to power. And that in that process of dialogue, the less powerful are left out of the equation. In this case, both the Muslims of this country and the Christians of the Middle East. So one question I put before you is, would it be useful to have a dialogue between Muslims of the United States and Christians of the Middle East to talk about some of these majority-minority relationships? That's a question I put out there. But secondly, I would be less than faithful to them if I did not at least convey some of the anxiety they feel at this point in history. And it relates to the question I asked earlier of Dr. Bedawi. And perhaps we can explore his answer a bit more. It has to do with the question of authority. Christians in the Middle East say to me, we have been part of this culture for centuries. We feel that we are part of Islamic culture, even if we have not become Muslims. We take part and take pride in Islamic culture. It is ours in that sense. The difference in the new age that we are facing is the inestimable power of the nation state, which has not been part of the Christian-Muslim reality in the Middle East in the past. The nation state is a relatively new phenomenon, and certainly the power of the nation state to enter into the lives of people in the way that it can is a relatively new phenomenon. Where Christians in the Middle East have expressed anxiety is to say, where is that authority that we can turn to that will be reliable? Who do we listen to? In a way, I think it's a restatement of Ivan's question. Who do we listen to in this new age to see where we fit in to Islamic society? I think those are the kinds of questions that perhaps are even more important than the technicalities that we will, I'm sure, be touching. We've already touched on them to some extent about permission to build churches or mosques or rights of proselytization, a whole question of apostasy laws. I'm sure we'll get into that. But I think I would hope that at least we have some time to discuss some of these underlying concerns that go beyond the legality but have a reality in people's lives that give them anxieties and hopes for the future.
Thank you.
I'd like first to tell you what I was planning to do. One is to raise the issue of dhimmis. I'll come to that word and why why is it that Islam divide people into Muslims and non-Muslims? Isn't that discriminatory? Does that give them a second-class position? Secondly, one remark again about the underlying or underpinning of Muslim attitude towards minority. And thirdly, that's the most important part, the duties and responsibilities. First of all, as you know, in nation states today, people are divided basically on rigid things that cannot be changed, that you cannot really change by language or skin color or others. Islam, being based on belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, chose to divide people differently. That classification of Muslim and non-Muslim, as we'll see, is not a classification of superior, inferior in terms of treatment, and we'll try to show that in a minute, especially when we explain the true meaning of dhimmi. A lot of people took the word dhimmi as an insult, and they lack the understanding between status or a state and a contract. Dhimma comes from the Arabic term which means covenant, and dhimmi means the covenanted people, the minority who are not Muslim living under the protection of Islam. And dhimma actually literally means that they had the covenant of God, His Messenger, and the believers, the Muslims, that their rights shall be protected and not infringed upon. In fact, I find that more advantageous than not having that distinction at all. If in a democracy, for example, you say, all right, everybody is the same, let's make it by votes, and you happen to have 5% Christians, they could be overwhelmed by the majority votes. But by having dhimma, or covenant, ingrained in the Quran, which is unchangeable, in the teaching of the Prophet, which is unchangeable, and a duty of the Muslim to follow on that, that means that this is irrevocable. Second aspect about covenanted people also, aside from being a contract, not a status, is that it is a different kind of contract also. It is an irrevocable, eternal contract. It can only be broken if a person, for example, become a Muslim, so there would be no need to classify him as dhimmi, and that's why it's open classification, not like classification by language, which he can change, or race. Or if the person leaves, chooses not to live with Muslims, and join countries that are hostile and fighting against Muslims, in which case he has already chosen not to be a covenanted person. Another aspect is that this distinction, like I said earlier, not only protects the rights of minorities, which otherwise would not be there if there is no distinction like this. In fact, as I'll see later, it may even make some of the punishments that could be meted to Muslims not applicable to them. A Christian, for example, who drinks, according to many scholars, cannot have the punishment for drinking. So by having that distinction, actually, would exempt him from the penalties that could be inflicted on a Muslim. The second point about the underpinning of Muslim attitude towards minorities. First of all, is what we mentioned earlier in the morning presentation in Surah 17, the dignity of the human being as a human being. Two, the concept of human brotherhood as we find in Surah 49. I'm not going to repeat that, just a reminder. But I'd like to add to that also, one important thing when people differ with you in religion, that appeared in Surah 60 in verses 8 and 9, in which it said, God does not forbid you, O Muslims, with respect to those who did not fight you because of your religion, or drive you out of your homes, that you should deal with them in kindness and justice, for God loves those who do good. It becomes not a matter of nicety, but a religious commitment and obligation to be kind to non-Muslim citizens living under Muslim protection if they are not hostile and working against them. Islam went farther than theory, and even in its laws, it provides permission for the Muslim to eat the meat killed by people of the book, in particular Jews and Christians, but not others. It allowed even some form of intermarriage between Muslim and Christian. And since the Quran says that marriage is peace, tranquility, love and compassion, how could one say that Islam teaches Muslims to hate or mistreat non-Muslims if that non-Muslim could be his own wife? It's very simple, very logical. Furthermore, the Quran also removes this attitude of fanaticism. I'm not saying some people will not be fanatic, but the Quran itself removes that attitude by clearly stating that if God willed, He would have made people all one nation, means one religion. But it says God will test you in what He gave you, like Dr. Haddad also referred to some of these statements in the Quran. Which means, indeed, that it tells Muslims, take it easy. Yes, there could be an issue of so-called theological correctness. A Muslim sees theological correctness in one way. وَمَنْ يَتَّغِي غَيْرَ الْإِسْلَامِ like Dr. Haddad referred to, that Islam is the true faith of all the prophets, not only of Prophet Muhammad, of all of the prophets, and this is the true monotheistic faith. That is theological correctness in the mind of the Muslim. Theological correctness in the mind of the Christian, that God came in the form of a human to save mankind through His grace. Everybody considers himself correct theologically. But the Quran also teaches that there is a big difference, and that's where I respectfully disagree with Dr. Haddad. There is a difference between the fact that you believe in this as the truth, and this is the theologically correct thing for you, and to infer from that because you are correct theologically, you have to mistreat somebody who is incorrect theologically. And these are two different things. Because the Quran always defers judgment to God in the Day of Judgment. In fact, one verse, لَيْسَ بِأَمَانِيَكُمْ وَلَا أَمَانِي أَهْلِكَ. It's not by your wishful thinking, you Muslims, or wishful thinking of the people of the book. So, theological correctness is for the Day of Judgment. In this life here, there could be nothing but justice. The other point that relates to that before coming to the specific right is what the Quran said it clearly, and I quoted in the first presentation. Universality of justice, even with the so-called enemy, let alone somebody living in peace with you, even though he doesn't share your religious belief. As far as the duties and responsibilities, I followed the same approach in human rights by dividing them along the five purposes of Sharia: protection of faith, religion, mind, honor, and property. Very quickly, protection of faith. The Quran is quite clear. Whether you believe yourself theologically correct or not, لا إكراه في الدين. Let be no compulsion in religion. And we find that this is not only theory, historically speaking. This is what the Prophet wrote to the people of Najran. This is what Umar, the second caliph, wrote to the people of Jerusalem. If you read the documents, it's quite clear that you're free to practice your faith. Nobody will interfere in your church. Nobody interfere with your clergy, their appointment or removal. It is all up to you, in addition to safety of your property and your practice. Secondly, the Quran clearly says that even if you, so-called, believe in your theological correctness and the incorrectness of others, don't degrade the religion of others, even pagans. In one verse in the Quran says, don't curse those gods that others worship beside Allah, so that those people will not be provoked to curse God. But for the people of the book in particular, it is much more than that. It says, tell them we believe in what has been revealed to us and what has been revealed to you. Your Lord and ours is one, and unto Him we submit. Which means, yes, there are differences, but try to look for the common ground. In addition to the verse cited earlier by several speakers, argue not with the people of the book except in ways that are best. That means respect their belief. You disagree, argue, but in a polite way. Thirdly, the aspect of religion that relates to practice of their faith in freedom, including, according to some scholars, the procession in their particular festivals. Scholars differ as to whether that could take place in a city where the great majority are Muslims or not. We find scholars like Abdul Karim Zidane said that if there is no problem of conflict or lack of public peace, it is permissible even in cities that are predominantly Muslim to let the Christian go even outside Idhar Sha'irah, and they go out in their procession. Fourthly, about the question of building churches or repairing churches or having new ones, I'm not getting into the details because I mentioned earlier that jurists did differ in so many issues. I'm giving you perhaps the one that I feel most adequate for a pluralistic society in which we live today. And the only issue that I find unanimity among scholars is only to prohibit building churches in Hijaz. That's in Mecca, Medina, Taif, and this particular, not the whole of Arabia even, in the area of Hijaz being the heart of Islam. It's just like asking to build a mosque in the Vatican. This is perhaps an analogy. And this is a very tiny place of the whole wide world. Other than that, I find, for example, people like Imam Shafi'i say that it is permissible for non-Muslims, Christians for example, to build churches even in Muslim predominant areas, or predominantly Muslim areas. Finally, on the question of religion, the point that I mentioned earlier on passing, and that is the issue of personal law. This is more than what modern democracies have done. In the United States, you can't have a Jewish divorce or Islamic divorce legally. It has to go through the court. So there's one set of secular laws that's imposed on everyone. Under Islamic system, 99% could be Muslim. The 1% Christians are not under the jurisdiction of Islam and Islamic courts in their personal law, and they are up to their own churches. The second aspect, protection of life. One, 4 points. First of all, as Ali radiallahu anhu, the first caliph, put it, that these people accepted the contract of dhimma, or covenant, or protection, so that their blood would be like ours and their money would be like ours. That's the safety of their person and property would be exactly like Muslims. The very famous statements, لَهُمْ مَا لَنَا وَعَلَيْهِمْ مَا عَلَيْنَا. For them, that's non-Muslims, what duties that we are required to do, they have the same obligation, and for them are the same privilege. Some people have misunderstood one hadith of the Prophet. I'm not going to detail that no Muslim could be killed because of killing a non-Muslim. This has been grossly misunderstood because it refers to people who were in fighting with Muslims. And that was in Mecca, after the conquest of Mecca, before the contract of dhimma or covenant was established. And there are references, authentic references, in the days of the Prophet and Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, one of the Umayyad rulers, that actually a Muslim was executed because he killed a dhimmi, a covenanted non-Muslim. Second point is the case of involuntary manslaughter. And the text is right there in the Quran, that the monetary compensation and the freeing of a slave is required of a Muslim, as it is from a non-Muslim, so long as you have a treaty or covenant with those people. Thirdly, in the question of qisas, or retribution for other than murder, like aggression or injury, again, according to the Hanafi jurists, it is exactly the same for Muslim and non-Muslims, which means a Muslim committing aggression against a non-Muslim would be entitled for having the same kind of retribution. Finally, something amazing. I was struck myself even to read it. That even if a non-Muslim kills or commits murder, the basic rule is that he is to be punished like a Muslim, just like in the United States in a secular law. They don't ask the religion of the murderer. The law applies to the sin because that's criminal law. But one amazing thing that is beyond democracies, liberal democracies today, is that in Islamic rule about murder, if the family of the deceased forgive, then it is okay. It is not a had, it is qisas. In other words, forgiveness is permissible. But again, my understanding in American law, even if the family forgives, the criminal must be punished. The third issue, the protection of dignity, as I called it, not just earth, dignity. First of all, if a Muslim commits adultery with a non-Muslim, a covenanted person, he has the same punishment. Number two, if a Muslim accuses a chaste woman of the people of the book of adultery, he is to be punished exactly as if he accused a Muslim woman, and he gets the 80 lashes for that false accusation. At least according to the Zahiri fiqh. Thirdly, the dignity involves the freedom of the person, just like a Muslim. You cannot be arrested arbitrarily without accusation. Freedom of movement. Freedom of being hurt or harassed. And let me give you three examples from the words of the Prophet. In one he says, if anyone do injustice, or commit injustice to a zimmi, a covenanted person, or take anything away from him that is his right, without his consent, or charge him with something beyond his capacity, then I will be the lawyer or the advocate of that Christian in the Day of Judgment. Imagine the Prophet would be against the Muslim standing on the side of the non-Muslim in the Day of Judgment. In another one, amazing hadith, he says anyone who would hurt a covenanted person, he hurts me personally as a prophet, and anyone who hurts me, he is hurting God. In another hadith, another version says, I will be khasmah, I will be his enemy,
litigator
in the Day of Judgment. No wonder we find people who were very much influenced by this teaching, like Umar, used to ask people coming from Ansar, from the various countries conquered, or opened, to be more correct, by Islam, asking them, how are the rulers behaving towards the covenanted people? Are they kind to them? And we have the very famous story when the local governor of Egypt Amr ibn al-As, his son, competed with a Christian, and the Christian won, so the son of Amr slapped him. And the man, his father, went to complain to Umar, and Umar brought Amr, and he gave the whip to the Christian boy, and he said, beat that son who called, I am the son of the more honorable people. Beat him. And after he beat him, and took his revenge, he turned to Amr, who was the local governor in Egypt, and he said, also, Adirha ala sal'ati Amr, hit the bald head of Amr also, because that his son would have not said that unless he felt that his father is powerful. But the Christian was fair. He said, no, I took revenge from the one who insulted me. We don't hear in history about anything that comes even closer to that. 1 minute? Okay. Half a minute. The other thing is to enjoy the various facilities of the states, including social security. There are some scholars, as we find Al-Mabsut al-Sarhasi, who say that they are entitled even to zakah, and according to Abdul-Karim Zidan, at least they are entitled from the share of al-mu'allafati qulubuhum, whose hearts need to be reconciled. That includes also work and taking any profession. I cannot continue further than that. There are a few more points on this, but I respect the time. But maybe the remaining issues of dignity, like public offices, witness, being in a position of a judge, and the issue of safeguarding of property, and the question of jizya, I hope this probably will be coming in the proper time and discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Interesting things were said. Responses from either or anyone.
Can I make some comments?
Muslims and Christians were each given 15 minutes.
No, I'm going to respond to some points that were raised,
sure,
and they really need to be addressed. On the issue of building churches, when the Quran spoke about the purity on earth and the corruption, it addressed it in a social movement, saying, had it not been for Allah pushing people by each other, then destruction would have overwhelmed, and it did not start by mosques. It said seclusion, places of worship, places of business, prayers, and mosques. And the places of seclusion in Arabic, Dr. Haddad, is sawama. The sawama where the priest or the minister would take seclusion in particular. So the Quran did not forward mosques before the sawama in attention, in importance, in this regard. So I believe that there is this kind of to me it is unsolvable problem, unfortunately. There is this assumption that others think as others and look at me as others too. And it works both ways. And it is difficult to remove. But I believe that the difficulty that Muslims face much more so than Christians is that a Christian can hold a Muslim by his book. You can open the book and say to the Muslim, you can do that to me. As a Muslim living under a Christian, predominantly Christian country, I can't open the Christian book or reference and say, here is what God says. I would like to hold you to that standard. In terms of detailed rights, I'm not talking about general principles. I'm not talking about general niceties that would come and go depending on who's in the office. I am talking about fixed, known, determined rights that no one should play with. It is extremely difficult. And I believe that the Christians are really put on a very awkward platform having to discuss this because of that same reason. That I can quote hundreds and hundreds of verses, traditions of the Prophet, statements, situations where Islam stood, as Dr. Badawi kept, reporting to us, while on the other hand, I find it quite difficult to find, and that is not the fault of the Christians or Christianity. After all, the Christian faith, as embodied in the Bible and biblical writings, has come well before the coming of Islam. How could it have foretold in detailed manners that there is a Muslim nation coming and these are the rights of these nations. What happened is that Christianity, in my humble view, only foretold about the Prophet, as Muslims assert from the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament. And Jesus has also foretold about false prophets. I believe if Jesus had believed that there will be no prophets after him, he would have made a very short statement. I don't need to warn people against false prophets. I can tell them anyone coming to claim prophethood, he is not a prophet. But that's not what he said. So the whole thing about Christianity not addressing the rights of Muslims makes it quite difficult for Muslims to feel at ease and at peace if they live as minorities in a predominantly Christian society. And I have other comments to make, but I would like to leave time for others to participate.
Yes, okay. Yvonne, did you want to...
Just briefly, as I've written this 40-page paper, everything you said is in this paper. I also have the ideas of the way in and out, which go beyond you mostly cut about. And it's incredible stuff, some of the new interpretations. But there are interpretations. And, you know, and you say that you hold us to the book. And the question is that if you take what is happening in Cairo today, some of the Jamaat and Islamiyah are holding the cops there to the book and saying, well, you know, the Jizya Bukhari Sahihun. And therefore they're saying they demand. It's interpretation, maybe. I'm not saying that that's what the right interpretation is. But they are using the book. And this is what I'm talking about right from the beginning. This is why I quoted the scripture. Because who is interpreting the scripture? And our biggest problem is, right now we don't have a Christian state. Okay? We have a secular state. And the rights, theoretically, are equal for everybody. But, you know, my name is Haddad, I may be treated differently, right? But that's not the issue. The issue is we don't have a Christian state. And you cannot take the Bible and say it. But if we did have a Christian state, maybe you could take the Bible and say it. But I don't know. But there is a demand for a Muslim state. And the issues the issues I am raising now are the issues people raise when I give this lecture, which goes even beyond what Dr. Benelli said about Samaritan Islam. And these are the issues that come from the audience who say, okay, explain to me then, if we are going to hold them by the book, why do they come say, quoting the Quran, and say, well, I'm sorry, and what does that mean?
Okay. Can I respond?
Yeah, okay. Maybe some of these terms are slipping by some in the audience, so you may want to translate the Arabic.
No,
I
know.
Okay. Two basic points. The first is that when you speak about interpretations, I get to disagree with the Dr. Haddad. She's a very good friend of mine. I have the greatest respect of her. But if I understood you to say that these are new interpretations, the answer is that's not the case. Some are new interpretations. Some, as I quoted when I referred to Al-Mafsud, the Sarkasi or the Hanafi Fiqh, I'm referring to interpretation that...
Okay.
Okay.
And therefore, I'm saying that this is an innate interpretation.
No, I don't think
that. That it is over.
Yeah.
Because they said we had the covenant and we said we will protect them
no.
And we didn't.
I think it's a matter of terminology again. Let me explain that.
Just to clarify this, that Dr. Bedri mentioned that the Dhimmi is not a status, it's a contract which is eternal. Now, I think that's if you lived in the Middle East, that's very, very significant because something that's a contract and eternal can never be changed or modified. So let's hear.
I'm glad that Dr. Haddad raised this issue because sometimes there is a little bit of misunderstanding of what it means. What I mean by eternal here, that it is not up to the government to come at any time and to tell to the covenanted person, you have no protection anymore. Eternal, it means it does not need any renewal as such. It gives him protection. What Muhammad Salim al-Awwa and others are saying, it's different. What they're simply saying that in a pluralistic society like today, where both Muslims and Christians participate in all affairs of the state, there is no longer a need to have the classification of dhimmi or non-dhimmi. In other words, that was used at the time when it was useful for certain purposes.
But there is no need.
When Christians were a majority.
Exactly. Exactly. So there is no contradiction. What I'm simply saying is that if the contract of Zimma is there, you cannot deprive the covenanted people from it. But is it religious to have Zimmis? Not necessarily, except in one thing that is protected in the Quran, that they are not subject to your rules in the matter of personal law. They're not to be punished for drinking because in their religion they believe it to be lawful. The other also point that I see there's some big clouding about it. When you talk about, for example, whose interpretation to take, like I said earlier, Islam is not a monolithic thing. And through the process of ijtihad is not individual. And I don't know whether you consider that fortunate or unfortunate. Muslims don't have a fault. That was the mistake in the media, that when some statement come about Rushdie, oh, this Islam. That's not Islam. Mm-hmm. In Islam, qualified scholars could differ, could offer more than one opinion. It's subject to debate. And usually throughout time, just like it happened in science and other disciplines, the evidence is discussed, and you can easily discover that some opinion gets more prominence because of the stronger evidence. Some opinions that are not accepted at one time, with the change of circumstances, wisdom in those opinions can be seen. Now, when you say that people, for example, like Jihad and others, would say, no, that these people should pay jizya or tribute, عن يد وهم صاغرون, again, mm-hmm. we come to the translation. People who do that, or who try to make this interpretation, are exactly like the same people who pointed to the Bible and said, this justifies the Crusades.
Of course.
And the reason why this you get this erroneous type of interpretation is oppression. The government is preventing even what the West called moderate Islamic movement from operating openly. Mm-hmm. Under that oppression, by arresting, torturing people, up to killing even in prisons, always you provide an atmosphere for these extremist opinions to arise. Imam Shafi, this is not a new thing. When he explained Saghirun, he said many people have misunderstood the word Saghirun, min al-Saghar, that means that they are humiliated. And he said this is very erroneous. And said linguistically actually, Saghirun means يقبلون أن تجري عليهم أحكام الإسلام, that they accepted to live under the Islamic state, under Islamic law, except of course for the areas where they have their own laws. That's Saghar, it is not humiliation, as some in the past have interpreted. This is not new. It goes back to Imam Shafi'i. So this is the problem, the solution.
I agree.
Education.
That's exactly what I'm
and
saying.
And open scholarly
right.
discussion.
Right. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Added to that, they yeah. can revoke that covenant if they wish to. So it is not compulsory on them to live under that covenant.
But it's compulsory on you to...
It's compulsory on the state to provide the protection if they accept that protection. If they don't, they can live without it.
Don't misunderstand me. All I'm saying is, I mean, there are a lot
no,
of Catholics who would
point.
Like to go
no.
back to the Zimmi state because we're they find the present regime is very oppressive.
If they apply it right...
Yeah, of course.
If they apply it right and Islamically, in yeah. perspective... It provides protection. That's all what it does.
Then I'm agreeing yeah. with you completely. All I'm saying is that we both, in both religions, we have room for interpretation.
But there is a minimum. This is a point I would like to address
yeah.
here. Islam really has spoken extensively about the rights of the people of the book, in particular, the Jews and the Christians. And spoke extensively, specifically, about the rights on Muslims. As neighbors, as wives, as children, so on and so forth. So, beyond the minimum stated, there is room for interpretation, of course. But the guarantee in the text is for the minimum protection that provides peace, provides room for dialogue, and so on and so forth. One of the points that you raised about theological differences, you know, no religion is accepted beyond Islam. That theological difference is recognized in Quran, yet the rights are still mentioned there for people of different religions, which means it is a lesson for Muslims not to withdraw or rather draw the theological differences into the political and social structure of the society so that in a degree or a way deprive the minority citizens from the political and social rights that Islam gave them. Mm-hmm. So the theological difference is not part of the political structure, is not part of the social rights. Indeed, Islam makes so clear, as mentioned before, that those rights are not ought not to be abrogated by anybody, ought not to be violated by anybody, even if they disagreed totally. And the Quran quoted the disagreement and quoted the reasoning for disagreement. You must have read the Quran talking about why Christians say about this, about Jesus, so on and so forth, and the answer to that, with full respect to Jesus, to his mother, to the whole issue, a very scholarly discussion, if you will.
No, I want you to know, I want to start right off. Please don't misunderstand me. There is no question that Christians have had a better life under Islam than Muslims have had under, you know, Spain or any of the other. I'm not saying that. Please don't misunderstand.
No,
absolutely. Okay. What I'm saying is that there is in Egypt at the moment some literature which is very extremist, which interprets certain verses of the Quran that are scaring.
There is also
the Christians.
There is also literature that say Egypt is a Coptic country and Muslims ought to live out of this place that is ours. Go to Arabia if you
I haven't
Muslim.
Seen it, but I would love to get hold
I
of it. I'm looking for it.
It.
Do you have
some of it?
I would love it.
Yes, it is in New Jersey anyway.
New Jersey, yes. Oh, yes. Now
and it comes out of Bani Mazar and all of this area.
Well, I
don't think we should judge anything by New Jersey.
No, we're just bringing Egypt with the whole of it.
No,
here,
no.
Which is a very vivid picture. You have those on both sides.
Oh, I know.
And I think
I started by saying
we agree that they do not represent neither the correct understanding of either religion nor the correct stand of the religion.
Mm-hmm.
And also to distinguish between the interpretation of ignorant people, quite frankly. Somebody, a young man, for example, who just read a couple of books, and he says, I interpret. And between the mainstream of scholars, check with variety of even schools of jurisprudence all over the Muslim world or in Egypt and see how many people would agree with this. So it's, like I said, it's a very extreme case of people under oppression just coming up with some of the crazy ideas.
No, I agree. But that's what I get hit by every time I lecture. Those are the questions that are raised.
Well, those are very, very real questions. You were mentioning the concerns of the, say, the Christians in the Middle East. And you may want to elaborate on this, because my feeling is that when there are those in the government, say in Egypt, who want to say that Sharia, go back to Sharia, as the only source of law, i.e. go back to the Zenmi system and so on, the Christians all head out and they fast and they pray, and that's the last thing they want. Okay? Now,
who said that? There is absolutely no ground anywhere in any school of thought for 1,500 years that says the Zimmis should fast and drink. The whole presentation I'm saying that the Zimmis are exempt even from punishments that are inflicted on Muslims, and they have no less size, except in very rare exception, like being a head of the state, because the head of the state in Islam protects faith and run that.
Maybe.
In a very rare situation like that. Otherwise, they have the same right, they're not obliged to follow Muslim faith, and they're exempt from... I'll give you one example.
Excuse me, my point was that if they want to make the Sharia the only source of law, positive law, that the Christians ask, well, what does this mean, actually, in detail? We've heard a lot about there's so much clarity.
Yes.
But many of them say, if we want a detailed... description of what this would mean.
Ask a specific question.
Cases, you see, that no answer is forthcoming.
I think the problem again is lack of understanding what Sharia is and stands for. Applying Sharia means that you don't interfere in their personal law. But they understand it differently. But that's lack of understanding. They think that Sharia means we have to follow Muslim law in every respect. No, it is part of Sharia to let them have their own Sharia, if you might, well, in their personal affairs.
If I could interject, although I'm really reluctant because this is it's a good discussion, I think. I was asked some time ago to write a little treatise on religious freedom in the Middle East. And that already was a challenge to write a little treatise on religious freedom in the Middle East. But one of the distinctions that I found useful in doing that is in talking about what we mean by freedom, and I think this applies then both to both the Middle East and elsewhere, and the United States. That's where I'd like to shift some of this discussion back as well, is what do we mean by religious freedom, I understand that as being both a freedom from certain things, and Dr. Bedouin has certainly referred to those limitations upon the powers of the government, an Islamic government, the Sharia faithful government, what it can and cannot do in terms of the dhimmis. And that's fine. Freedom from persecution, freedom from desecration of religious places, freedom from interference in worship. There are all kinds of freedom froms. Where I think the difficulty comes, and I think it's a difficulty both here and elsewhere, both in this country and in the Middle East and elsewhere, is in a second kind of freedom, which is the freedom for, the freedom to do certain things. For I see in both traditions a desire to create in their society something that is faithful to the religious tradition. I mean, I see that impulse in the United States among Christians who say we really need to make this a more Christian country. We should institute Christian prayers in the public schools because we're a Christian country. I can imagine that the temptation, and probably it has been succumbed to at various times, in Islamic environments is to say, well, you know, it would really be much better in our society if we really had a pure Islamic society in which Islamic values permeated absolutely every corner of our lives. And to me, a big question is, what are the limitations on this freedom for, on the two traditions? And then I'd like to recapture at some point some of the spirit of the earlier discussion, because when I said something about the church's responsibility about the kind of attacks that have taken place on Muslims and on Islam in this country, I think that there is maybe some room for all of us to take responsibility in these areas. And at certain points, perhaps, to say some things together about these things. I know that the Catholic bishops made a very important statement along with the Muslim World League at some point. And I wonder if there are some things we might do. I'm sorry I introduced about two or three different things, but I'd really like some discussion about this. The freedom for, because I think it lies at the heart of this question of Sharia and what makes Christians a little bit afraid.
Excuse me, just according to our schedule, preaching the freedom for preaching their faith, for building places of worship, for holding positions of government. But let's just take 5 minutes on this, and we want to bring in the other part. And
then... No, just to make a very brief answer. From my own experience, I have run into high school in Egypt. And this is what I've seen done. I hope it's still being done. Because that was very tolerant. First of all, when we used to go as kids, some of you might remember those who come from Egypt. It was what you might call an ecumenical prayer. Ya ilah al-alamina, ya mujib al-sa'ilina, hab lana minka rashadan wa sadadan wa yaqina. Nothing that's offensive to Christian or Jew. O Lord of all mankind, all the universe, O you who respond to those who pray to you, give us guidance and success in our lives. I have no problem at all if somebody in a Christian in the United States bring Muslim children and have a statement like that, but not necessarily say, and in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, to have truly ecumenical, I have no problem with that. Secondly, whenever we had a religious class, religious studies class, I have seen it with my own eyes. At the same time that our Quranic study classes are scheduled, they would also collect the minority Christian from different classes, bring a priest, and they go to their own class and they go on their teaching. And I read you this morning from the statement from the head of the church, the Eastern Church in Sudan, that the government even trained a teacher, give them all opportunity, let them have their own Christian curriculum to teach their own children. I wouldn't mind it in America, even though I know there is a constitutional problem there, but I wouldn't mind it at all if teaching Christian values or religious values would be presented in the school, either in an ecumenical way, not necessarily from one point of view or the other, in an comparative religious standpoint, mm-hmm. in a fair academic way, or to have Christian values taught, but allow Muslims also to have Islamic values taught, and it's beneficial for both.
Okay.
Just one minute.
You're being censored.
one of the things that Islam brought to the scene is the recognition of the Jews and the Christians as a community. Mm-hmm. It is mandated on Muslims to recognize these as a very integrated part of our community. So the so-called pure Islamic society, as being quoted here, does not necessarily mean extermination of others or elimination of others or driving them out or ethnic cleansing, in other words. So the pure Islamic society is a society that resembles the Quran, dealing with Muslims and Muslims, pagans, idol worshippers, anybody that comes in a fair way, in a just way. So the pure Islamic society, as people try to say, we want a pure Islamic state, it doesn't necessarily mean extermination of others. I want this to clear.
Thank you, that's important. Could I ask four others to join us? The discussants, Jean and Lois, would you be willing to come and join us? Mohammed and Sister Bay. Okay.
I'm publishing it.
I think it's a good idea to not
emphasize.
You would be welcome to join us.
Could I join you?
We're all on the same side.
Please.
The side of God, I hope.
Good, thank you.
With the blessing of Dr. Haddad establishing new world order here.
We see together.
All right, who would like to make the first comment or observation? Muhammad.
I find it in a way quite legitimate for minorities in a predominantly Muslim societies to have certain concerns as to what the future would hold for them when an Islamic state is established. And I think that they do have the right to ask questions. And I think that we do have the right to get convincing answers to those questions. That in recognition of the historical gap that has taken place for a host of reasons between the last model Islamic State that was in existence and the present time, and also in light of the environment, the present environment in which many of those Muslim societies exist, from lack of freedom, oppression, and so on. However, I would also argue that non-Christian minorities, or maybe even Muslims, do have legitimate reasons living in non-Muslim societies, predominantly Christian societies. Now, we seem to be equating the West in general as a whole, as a lump sum of communities, whereas in fact, at least in my personal opinion, I think the West is in fact, its treatment of minorities is not all the same. The Western part of Europe has vividly taken a distinct part, distinct position, distinguished from at least the predominant position of the Americans regarding the minority or the situation in the Balkans, the Bosnians. So that gives the legitimacy to Muslims as a minority living under a non-Muslim society to probably have those questions addressed, especially when lives are indeed at stake. I'd like to raise that issue and see whether there are thinking from the Christian as well as the Muslim side related to the treatment of minorities in a religious context from a Christian standpoint.
Can
you answer?
Sure.
Right. Jean, did you want to venture a comment?
That's going to be my most popular comment. George Bush talked this country into bombing the Iraqis. 150,000 dead Iraqis, minimally. I feel terrible about, and it comes from my faith perspective, the treatment of the Muslims, the treatment of minorities in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But I have never seen the United States engage militarily anywhere where there wasn't more slaughter as a result. So I personally am very hesitant to say that there should be this bombing with these so-called smart bombs, only 7% of which hit the right targets. And I'm very concerned about that, because I do feel that other countries have a responsibility to the minority communities that are suffering there. But I, in my, 55 years of experience, I have never seen the United States do it for purely generous reasons. And when we have engaged with some full military hoo-ha, we have wound up slaughtering and subsequently, usually, enslaving somebody. So, I think the world, I would like to see the Europeans get involved in this in some way. And I would like to see the United States kept under control in any kind of event that goes on there.
Could I have just a very brief comment on that? I think the issue really has been repeatedly stated by the Bosnian government, that we say we don't want other armies, we don't want even other people to bomb for us, but they feel very, very unfairly treated under the so-called arms embargo, because it's well known that the Serbs have all the power and all the resources of the Serbs and the former Yugoslav army. Muslims have nothing. They were comparing 15 tanks with, 700 tanks that the Serbs have. So I think what they feel is that there have been a great deal of double standards, if not sheer hypocrisy on the part of some countries, as well as the United Nations, in fact, by saying, no, we don't want to add fuel to the fire, while letting Muslims being slaughtered for 13 months, even if they just lifted the arms embargo, they would have been able to defend themselves. So I think the issue is not just going on and bombing or killing someone else, enabling people to defend themselves and to take out those equipment that is killing civilians every day.
One of the things that is a real proof to the failure of the American foreign policy in particular is the hypocritical stand that when the United Nations was, representatives were blocked in Iraq from doing what? Inspecting weapon sites, which is, could be done today, could be done tomorrow. Iraq was bombed, and bombed severely, okay, until it got on its knees. When the same United Nations people were prevented by military force from providing what? Humanitarian and medical aid to injured, to children, to women, the United States sat down and looked and said, maybe we need to have tougher sanctions, as if they had believed that sanctions worked on Iraq. And they have said all along, sanctions alone are not going to do it, and this is why they bombed Iraq. This is why they sent 500,000 men and women to fight. So this hypocritical thing cannot be understood in congruency with neither Christianity, nor Islam, nor American foreign policy, except in a hypocritical context. And this brings a lot of pain to many Muslims, because you look at the situation there, and we are talking about minorities, and we cannot ignore this slaughtered minority there in the heart of Europe, where the NATO alliance do not lack the weapons. They are not waiting for the United States to send people. They should be moving. And correctly stated by Joe Biden after his visit to Bosnia, and when the Secretary of State was testifying in the Senate, Biden said, had this, we know, and the European community know for assuredly, that if Muslims were doing what the Serb are doing today, that could have been a completely different story. And it calls upon the integrity of the United States, it called it into question, from the popular standpoint to the administrative political standpoint. People are not rising up in arms in America because of justice.
And I believe that the media has a responsibility too. But I believe also that the Christian, Muslim, Judaic, ecumenical community in America did not take a solid stand to make their loud voice penetrate through the White House and the Senate and the Congress to make sure that justice is done. At least similar treatment, the minimum.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to go back to what I thought was a kind of underlying question beyond Bosnia, and I agree with the comments that have been made in terms of double standards. I think not only in the case of Bosnia, but also in the case of Palestine, in the case of Lebanon, in the case of Cyprus. There have been a whole series of UN resolutions that have been enforced or that have not been enforced, and then suddenly we have a series that were meticulously enforced, even beyond being enforced. In the case of Iraq, where the no-fly zone, which was never sanctified by a UN resolution, nevertheless supposedly justified a U.S. bombing raid. So I think that the accusation of a double standard sticks, and it's an issue that we ought to be facing together. If we believe in the United Nations, and all these years we said we did. But I think on the underlying question, which is, do Muslims have things to fear when they are a minority in non-Muslim societies, which I heard that question being asked, is I think they do. I think that there are all kinds of violence that can be perpetrated, that can, they may start off as a kind of intellectual violence or as a kind of verbal violence, but nevertheless can lay the groundwork for...
The rise of the neo-Nazi movement in Europe is the clearest indication of the attacks not only on Muslims as a minority, but they extend to cover other minorities as well.
I think that's right. I think the one group that does not seem to be protected by concerns about fairness, at least the group that I think of most immediately in terms of media coverage, are Muslims or Arabs. I think that caricatures are allowed, which would not be permitted for other groups and should not be permitted for any group. I think that there are other more subtle forms of violence. I feel that it is a violence against Muslims every time we talk about the Judeo-Christian tradition in the United States. That is a form of the violence of exclusion. And it assumes that there are not shared values along with Muslims and others who could be included in that. So I don't know. I think we need to look at that kind of violence as well. And I do believe that there is reason to be afraid in these societies, and that's where I think the obligation of people in the religious communities is to support each other from these kinds of manifestations of prejudice.
I'd like to make a point in conjunction with that. Recently, since the World Trade Center bombing, Jersey City has been nicknamed the Little Baghdad across the river. With what Brother Shacker had brought up earlier, Muslims, whether this is a secular society or Christian society, whichever, they overlap frequently. There is not a protection that is guaranteed. There is a constitutional protection for people, but there is also, this can be slanted and slid around, and I've seen it, if you're a minority and arrested, you have equal rights, but as white people used to say in the 60s, ours are a little more equal. And with the Muslim brothers that were arrested for the bombing, this is a perfect example. One of them accused of slugging an FBI agent. Well, 25 of them were surrounding him with MAC-10s. And since they broke into the house across the street from me to arrest, you know, people and take boxes of things out of the house, I would really doubt that any brother would be stupid enough to slug an FBI agent who had a MAC-10 machine gun in his hands. So, but he's in prison with no chance of bail or anything else, which is denial of a constitutional right. He didn't do anything except supposedly obstruct justice. which means that he didn't talk to the guys. But he's, you know, without bail for more than, he'll be in at least a year before the trial. This is a denial of a constitutional right by means of, and I sincerely believe, religious prejudice, persecution. So, you know, this is a fear for Muslims. Having been through the 60s, having been through civil rights prejudice and all of the rest, battered women thing, I am not reassured by the existence of secular law or constitutional law or anything else that exists in the society. And I think this is a very real fear for Muslims right now, what we see, not just in Iraq, but what we see here. I can tell you that walking down the streets in Jersey City and riding the subways is not one of the more comfortable things that you do. I carry CS2 gas in case of attack, because you can't carry a weapon in Jersey City on your person. It's a very scary time. People look at you as though you're some sort of an American traitor. There's something wrong with you. I've had beer cans thrown at me in other places. This was during Persian Gulf. We've been spit on to the point where the brothers would not allow the sisters to go anywhere by themselves. I was escorted to my job and back. We live in a situation that could become very volatile. I personally believe if the Waco thing had been a black religious cult, as one of our imams said at our demonstration in Jersey City, if that had been homeboy Quraysh in there instead of this Seventh-day Adventist white person surrounded by other white, nice, moderate people from Waco, that he would have been gone in 48 hours, right after he shot the FBI agents. If it had been Muslims with 8,000 pounds of ammunition sitting in a building in Texas or anywhere else, we would have been gone long before 57 days. We'd have shot 4 FBI agents, and that would have been the end of it. They'd have blown us to kingdom come. These are serious concerns that exist here, and that concern me as much as the situation in Iraq or as much as Bosnia, in more ways because I have children here to protect. And this is a very serious issue, and I think this group, which is obviously very ecumenical, needs to very quickly get its act together, because in New York right now, for instance, the Christian right has made a major move on the school boards to take over the school board. They've already managed to get Jose Fernandez fired. They're moving quickly. It is a major movement made by these people to take the school boards. And I agree with Dr. Bett. It would be wonderful to have a nice prayer, a rather ecumenical prayer, teaching of values. But in this country, as I told Lois earlier, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. The louder you are, the more attention they pay to you. And the Christian right is very good at being loud.
Especially
if you're politically organized, and we are not. The National Council of Churches has done a great deal of good work. I get most of their publications, but we need to do a lot more to protect one another, because the Christian right won't be any happier with you than they are with us. So we, those of us thinking very liberally here, need to come together very quickly.
Well, let's, I don't know that I have a mic here, but let's open it up for questions from the audience here.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? My name is Ali. I'm an Iranian-born, non-practicing Muslim for 20 years in the U.S. Since second grade elementary school, I've been raised in American schools. And since Bosnia, I've become very interested in Islam. Before making a point on a more general issue, I would like to respond to the sister. Am I referring to you correctly?
Anything.
Okay. You pointed out what happened in Iraq, 150,000 people slaughtered, and that is why you are hesitant about the U.S. going into Bosnia. I respectfully reject your misinformation. There are women and children being slaughtered. The U.S., France, and England, the leaders of the civilized world, went to the UN and tied the hands of the Bosnian Muslims behind their backs, and now they are being slaughtered. they went to the UN and they put an arms embargo on all of Yugoslavia, and to assume that the intelligence services of the West did not know where those arms were sitting is rather painful for me. I cannot assume that the leaders of the civilized world knew very well what they were doing. I have been very proud of being an American that has been shaken now from Bosnia.
What would you suggest they do?
I'm not in a position to suggest that the American government do anything.
Why not?
I'm not in a position. I don't know. However, I do see, as the brothers pointed out, hypocrisy and double standards of pride. As a child, I lived in Iraq. My father was a diplomat. He worked for the Shah's government for 36 years. And then I saw what happened to Iran. And I stayed here in the U.S. I have personal experience with the Middle East. I do believe that Saddam Hussein is, it applies, the butcher of Baghdad. I have no sympathies for him. I don't believe he should have gone and conquered, you know, Kuwait. No problem there whatsoever. However, the U.S. response, not waiting for sanctions, is something I noticed. And also, why did the U.S., the leader of the civilized world, need to destroy the economy of Iraq? Why did they need to drop oil bombs on power plants? That only causes the complete destruction of the power grid. That power was supplying water to children. And why did they not get Saddam Hussein? These are questions I have. What do I think they should do in Bosnia? Number one, they should not have tied the hands of the Bosnians.
But now, what?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not in a position to tell the U.S. or the Western world what to do.
No, I don't want to discuss that. We really can't be out of communication. We're going to be on at 8 o'clock. And so we can carry on in the
What if you think?
Dr. Vogler, there is a suggestion to continue this for another 20 minutes and conclude. Can I do that?
I see. So that makes it also informal, so that you take your role.
Yes.
I think the discussion towards the end became highly politicized.
Once the truth becomes a casualty, that we're all at risk. And I just couldn't, you know, stand. I'm not one to come up and speak, but I could not stand sitting there without saying anything when I see and when I hear misinformation.
Thank you. Would someone that you'd like to respond?
Not as much to respond. I think he made his point very well and he elaborated on his feelings. Most of us probably share the same feelings with regards to the atrocities of Bosnia. However, I'd like to take another spin on the discussion of minorities and again bring it closer to home here with a little a couple of stories I'd like to relate. I had a friend of mine who has been in this country for over 25 years. He's an engineer. He's been working for a company for over 22 years of his stay in the United States, and he was laid off in the past recession, which probably continues. He looked all over for a job, and he went to an employment company, employment agency, and the person that was taking care of his resume and his file at that company told him, frankly, that he is, you know, the power that he's up against, and he said that you have a handicap, and the man looked at himself and he said, I'm not handicapped, I'm physically fit, I don't smoke, drink, this, that, or other, and told him that your name serves as a handicap. His first name is Muhammad, and he said that if you put a different name, at least a different first name, other than what you have, he was very frank with him, and he was an American, you know, of the Anglo-Saxon community, if you will. So that was a shocking statement to make to that particular individual. Another story that I'd like to probably also equally relevant is I work in a company that can be considered a very liberal environment, a research and development blue chip kind of company, and I work as a computer scientist. And one of the programs that they had, to the extent of being as liberal as they are, was just a meeting just like this on women in Islam, to which I was asked to address. And one of the points that they brought about is many of them, even among the women that were present, some of them are department heads and engineers, said that, yes, we went to schools and universities in Chicago, in Illinois, in other urban places, we saw Muslim women studying the same classes that we were taking, and they excelled, and they did very well in the academic arena. But when we came to corporate America, we didn't see any of them. And at this point, they recognized that there is an environment that kind of worked as an obstacle for those career-oriented women that deter them or outright reject them from being, you know, given the full potential of their whatever they learned in the schools. So that, in fact, also brings the point of minority relations closer to home. I'd like to see if you wish to address this particular issue. Anyway.
I agree with what Brother Muhammad is saying. I know for my own self, I'm a public school teacher, college teacher. I went in, I was accepted for a job. There was no problem. I went to the job in hijab and told them, this is who I am. They didn't have a problem. This was in the African-American community. They had no problem with this. I went into the main personnel division to get my contracts, my papers. The first thing they asked me for was my green card. I was born in the northeast side of Washington, D.C., raised on the northwest side above Embassy Row, where all the Middle East embassies are presently located. I told them I don't have a green card. And they said, well, you can't work here until you have one. I said, look, lady, I said, my English is definitely better than yours, and I am definitely from here. And she looked at me. I had to actually get a driver's license, you know, get ID. She did not believe this. She wanted a green card. So that if you dress like this, I'm sure she wouldn't have asked a nun, and I'm usually taken as a nun, or an Orthodox Jew. Back home in my mother's community, which is heavily Jewish and German, I will be taken for an Orthodox Jew. So, you know, one or the other, there is a very definite slant against us in public life. I cannot work as a paralegal in any major law firm because of this. It's like your brain died and you can't go to work for them. It's a very limited selection. I have to decide between wearing a scarf or going to work. In many cases, it's illegal to wear this in a school system.
Okay. Any more comments? As an answer to the previous question. Okay? I know there are more questions out there.
I don't know if I have an answer, but I've been doing research on the Muslim community in the U.S. And most of you know that I've been doing this work for a long time. And one of the things I found out is they have done, you know, the same
treatment you got has been meted out to other groups. I'm not justifying that it happens, and I'm always fighting and saying, why does it have to be so? It's very un-American. And you know, if we take them to the book and say, okay, this is very, you know, you have the Constitution, it is an un-American way of treating people. At the same time, I am told that if the Muslim community perseveres, if the Muslim community is willing to participate in the process of changing the situation, it would help. And the reason I'm talking about it is that there are some people in the general community, you know, in human rights and in the National Council of Churches, who are taking a stance, and they're always doing it by themselves. And if the Muslim community would learn to cooperate with them, it would help. It would show that they are participating in the process. But the tendency is for the Muslim community to talk to itself, to hide on itself. It's a typical minority attitude. But this is something that the Jewish community has faced, and look where they have become. The Catholic community, apparently when the Catholics came to the United States, they were considered terrible, and there's a whole literature on that. So all I'm saying, I'm not comforting anybody. I'm urging you to find people who will work with you and go to your senator and your congressman and demand your rights as an American. Hold them to the book. But you have to participate. You cannot hide. And the Christians can't do it for you. You have to work with them. I guess
yes.
I was partly going to say some similar type of things, that I think it does take political organizing. And we're back, Yvonne, to your issue about name an issue and then create some alliances. And one of them, this isn't...
Yeah, it works.
Okay. It's working? All right. One of them is around the issue of discrimination against minorities in employment. It's very un-American, but it's very American. And there's a long history of this as one group comes into the country after another, starting, of course, at the beginning. And I think we need to politically organize around that. And I think in the case of women, there really is a double jeopardy, and that I think it's not an accident in Bosnia that we're dealing with a double issue of Muslim and rape. Issues about which we mostly sort of avoid the issue. I think here, again, women need to organize across faith boundaries.
Sure.
Okay. The other thing I want to add is that...
hold it closer. Yeah.
Okay. One of my students did her PhD thesis, and she researched everything that is in the court system, you know, the cumulative judicial statements concerning Islam in the United States. And except for two about citizenship in the United States for Arabs or Muslims, all the other decisions have been initiated by African Americans. And there are in the books in the United States a lot of rights. For example, there was a case against that one woman who was employed by TWA because she started wearing the scarf. They fired her. She got her job back. There is a case of one professor. You know, there are discrimination cases in the courts that have been fought. Muslims have won a lot of rights. Most of it litigated, as I said, by African-American Muslims in the penal system. But it is there. It can be built on. And what we need is more Muslims who will participate. Now, to your issue, you know, I've had other people raise another issue about Bosnia. The question is, why is Bosnia being permitted to be shown on television? Because we have human rights violations in India about Muslims, in Kashmir, in Palestine. Why Bosnia? How come we get to see the pictures? I mean, I don't know. I have no answer. I have no... That is the question somebody raised to me. Why? What is the television station agenda in showing this? Because they could hide it. That is the question some people are asking. Why are they showing it? I have no answer.
I have an answer. They aren't showing it. The fish you're seeing now is about a year and a half old. Mm-hmm. We've got sisters here from Bosnia who helped make those noodles. Mm-hmm. And those noodles are about a year and a half old. We don't know what's going on there now. They're not showing it.
There's a question over here. No, it's not a question. Actually, they are not showing it. They are hiding over 99% of the truth, of the facts. I am an MD, and a drug rep just came from China, who happened to meet with me in this past week. And he was tremendously, you know, hurt by what he has seen in China, you know, on the China TV, which has not been ever projected here on the American media. And he was so, you know, he's American, he's an Anglo-Saxon American. And, you know, he was so, you know, terribly hurt by the fact that the truth is hidden from the public and the masses here. This is the only thing I would like to...
I don't know. I mean, I'm just sort
of... I have one more question. Did you want to make a comment?
Well, the whole thing about the media and where and how and why they make certain choices is most probably painted by political painted, colors. And because that issue came during the campaign, only then it became important for the media to cover it. Only then it became important to cover it regularly. And some networks are more attentive to it than others. You see ABC bringing it always on top of the news, always lengthy coverage, always on site. You see others bringing news about it, rather than extensive cover. So it really depends on the political agenda of the station and how they relate to the political agenda of the country. I have
I think there's also a possible, and I can't pretend to figure out the media's intent, but a possible answer to why Bosnia shows up on TV and say Kashmir does not, the slaughter of Muslims, is it Burma? I believe it's Burma. Cambodia and other places doesn't show up on the TV either. We have a racial question here also. Bosnia, although they're Muslim, they're white, they're European, this shows up. It gets people upset. Kashmir, Asian, Southeast Asia, these people are not white. And if you look at the history of America, wars, military strategies, etc., you cannot come to any other conclusion. We didn't drop bombs, even when the Jews were asking us to bomb things in Germany where concentration camps were located as early as 42. We did not bomb. And yet we dropped the bomb on Japan, on Hiroshima, as a means of getting them to stop fighting, is what I was always taught in school, because they wouldn't give up. It was their duty to die, so you drop a bomb on them. And I was taught that. And Vietnam, my generation's war, the Gook, the Slan Eye, you demonize the people before you destroy them. It's very hard, however, to get American majority people to demonize other white people. It's really harder to do that. They did not demonize the German. Not really. The Nazi, yeah. But really to demonize the enemy, they did not do it. But they will do it against any other cult, any other color group that is not Caucasian. And I think that's a point to consider in media presentation.
Okay,
I have a comment to the Iranian brother who said that he's social Muslim.
American.
I'm an American brother who never been Iranian, and he's American brother who is socially Muslim. I believe the problem here is your problem. Because if you studied the history a little bit, if you spend a little bit time when you were doing non-Islamic things, and you see that the United States, one of the greatest things about it, it's a constant in its hypocrisy. So you are the one who mislead yourself. You waited till Bosnia happens all those years. You did not find that the United States, with all that history with Israel and Palestine and Arab and Kuwait, and you needed Bosnia. This is a point against you. One point.
Excuse me, yeah. You have a question?
Yes,
Yeah, I think many of us would.
I would like to make a quick Well, I've been
one quick. Anyone have
it's very quick. The whole thing is
hold it up by your mouth.
The platform that we are in is a platform of understanding each other, not really condemning each other. And I believe that I know, inshallah, that everybody has good intentions and everything, but I believe that we should welcome the courage of the brother, we should welcome his intent, we should welcome his move to the truth, we should be grateful to Allah that he has enlightened him, and I really applaud him for his courage. So many people in his place did not have the courage to do it. I really applaud your position. JazakAllah
khair. Thank you. Yes.
I'd like to turn the discussion back to the issue of minorities. And with regards to Christian minorities who are living in lands with Muslim majority under secular government, I'm sure many of you and Dr. Varler himself is familiar with similar situations like in Lebanon and the Middle East. It is common practice, and I can speak of personal experience in Egypt, for instance, that the local Christian population, when feuds develop among them and disputes, they do not take it to the courts. They do not take it to the church. They take it to the local sheikh or imam of the local mosque to resolve it. This is very common. I'm not saying every situation, but it's very common. And especially in the case of Upper Egypt, they have indeed taken their own disputes to the local leader, if you will, of the Jamaat al-Islamiyya to resolve it from them. That if it proves anything, it hints to the fact of the fairness that the Christian population believe in the at least symbolically the Muslim people as opposed to the secular government or the court system.
Did you have a question?
I don't know if somebody would like to respond to this statement, but I also before I leave I would like to make another comment regarding to the media not depicting the situation in Bosnia or something. I'd like to bring the case of Sudan, for instance. We are every now and then hearing things and seeing things on the media with regards to the situations in Sudan in terms of the misery and starvation and the human rights, etc. But it seems like the media like to play this tone often and ignore the tremendous progress that the Sudanese government has achieved in terms of social and economic progress that have been commended by the entire observer agencies in the world, like the United Nations agencies, etc. Thank you.
Behind you, on the, yes.
The question of minorities, I just want to say that we can look at it back, as you mentioned, that most of those legal proceedings without entering court and opinions and decisions, a lot of minorities have done a lot. I think that what I would suggest is that a lot of Muslim-formed, non-for-profit corporations and focus on employment training, and the government will support you. They will fund you and liaise with, and there will always be discrimination in this country. It will never die. However, Muslims are very competent. You are the third. You have very competitive per capita. You are one of the most educated religious organizations in this country, including Jews and so forth. So let us form non-for-profit corporations whereby you can, if a person is being discriminated upon, that corporation can, let's say it's a social action agency, can use that their position to bargain for discrimination, and it could be very effective. On another end, when you mentioned the question of why they're not showing, why they're showing Bosnia, it's an ethnic situation. And there is a poet who said, the mouth is always muzzled by the food it eats. The press would only show what would make it commercialized and what would make it economical. One last thing suggestion I want to say is that I think this dialogue is very imperative at this point in our lives. and I hope that you would continue to have such a dialogue within the community. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, just have a quick question for Dr. Dale Bishop, and maybe Dr. Jamal Badawi makes a comment after that. I'm really curious to know how you understand the concept of jizya. And just out of curiosity, I want to know how you understand it. And then maybe we hear a comment from Dr. Jamal Badawi, since he didn't finish what he was about to say about the jizya.
Like everybody here knows what jizya is, right? Okay.
Is this a quiz?
I said at the beginning, I'm just curious how you understand. Is it the same understanding as mine or different? You see, because I had it understood different ways at the beginning. And then when I started to read about it, I removed all my wrong understanding. So I'm curious to know whether you had the same misunderstanding like myself or not.
Yeah. Well, you're waiting for me to say poll tax or tax on Christians or other minorities, non-Muslims. And I think that's the usual translation interpretation given, at least in the histories. I understand it that it has been interpreted by Muslims as that which is given in place of other things that minorities are not required to do, but which responsibilities are borne by the majority, such as fighting in a war, which you may not ask a non-Muslim to fight in a jihad, for example. So that this is in a kind of rough compensation for that and for other things that minorities may not be asked to do.
Well, I'm glad you didn't have the same misunderstanding as mine.
Mina passed. I think he passes with distinction, but just a few humble points for clarification. Well, first of all, obviously, jizya cannot be seen as punishment for people who did not accept to become Muslims. Because if it is a punishment, in fact, if they become Muslims, they will be paying more than jizya. They will be paying zakah. And as you know, zakah in Islam is approximately, depending on the source of income, but the most common one is 2.5%, not of income, but of assets, which could be quite a bit. What is intended for jizya and why make that distinction? Why don't Christians pay it as zakah? I think this is born out of the religious sensitivity to the feeling of Christians. You cannot go to a Christian under an Islamic state and tell him pay zakah, because zakah is not just a tax. Zakah also has a worship element in it. It's one of the pillars of Islam, so it has a religious connotation to it. But in the meantime, as you have rightfully said, when you have covenanted people, number one, they enjoy all the services of the state, including what we call today the social security. And we have an example in Medina when Umar, the second caliph, saw a Jew, an old Jew, begging, and he asked him why, and he was very upset. He said to the treasurer of the state, you might say, the minister of finance, that you should go around and look for any person like that and preserve their dignity by having a regular payment for them. So that means then both Muslims and non-Muslims under an Islamic state are entitled for those services. But where do you finance those? Just like the discussion in the Congress, where do you pay for these programs? Muslims are obligated to pay the zakah, and sometimes they have to pay sadaqah, and within Islamic law, the government may impose additional taxes if it's not enough to take care of the state, and they have full right to enjoy that like Muslims. Would it be fair then that only the Muslim majority carry the full burden and the minority would have nothing? It's not for their dignity also to feel that they are freeloaders. So that's one element. The second element is that Muslims are obligated to defend, but the defense is a little different from the concept of defense in modern armies or states, nation states. Defense in Islam has a religious connotation also. It is jihad. It's struggle to protect the faith and the people in that community of faith, which means that it would be embarrassing to ask a non-Muslim to put his life on the line and make him sacrifice his life for a religion
that he does not believe in. However, you'd be surprised to know that there have been exceptions also in Islamic history, and that provide a basis for new jurisprudential interpretation. Number one, there have already been recorded cases like the letter by Uqbah ibn Farqad to the people of Azerbaijan, that these people offered to protect the borders against any enemy attack. So he wrote to them that anyone who engaged in that, he would not have to pay the jizya for that year that he's participating in this. Number two, a very famous case, Ubaidah ibn al-Jarrah, when Muslims were in Syria, they took the jizya from Christians in Syria. And then they realized that Heraclius had collected a very huge army, and they were unsure whether they will be able to fulfill their dhimma, or the covenant contract they have with them. You know what he did? He ordered that the jizya that was collected from the Christians be returned to them. And some historians say that the Christian clergy at that time were very impressed, and they said to them, if these were the Romans who were claiming to be Christians, if these were the Romans, they would have not returned a penny to us, they would have even taken whatever is left with us. To the point that they prayed for barakah, for blessing for the Muslim army, and prayed that they would have victory over the Romans. So there is an established jurisprudential principle that jizya could also be removed if a person offers to participate in the defense, or if Muslims are unable to defend them. Furthermore, actually you'll find that the jizya amount is less than what Muslims even pay for zakah. It's even an additional consideration to the non-Muslims. Jizya, number one, is imposed only on males, not females. It's imposed on able-bodied people, not on all people. The clergy are exempt from that. And that's amazing, because the zakah in Islam is obligation on both male and female. And that proves, indeed, that it is imposed on people who are able-bodied. So it's a matter of like substitute of participation in the defense of the country. And then there was one amazing incident. Some of the Arabs in northern Arabia, when Umar, tried to arrange for them to pay jizya, they say, we don't like jizya. We don't like it. To them, in their Arab background and culture, they felt it is humiliating for them. Umar asked them, how do you want to pay? Say, we want to pay it as sadaqah, as charity. He accepted that from them, if the term is offending to them. See how much even accommodation could be added. And finally, one more point. Jizya is not a matter of belief, of absolute cornerstone of Islam. And there are modern Muslim jurists today who say that if there is no need even for collecting it, there's no need for it. In modern systems, for example, where Muslim pays a tax, and the state might impose on top of that some additional tax on both Muslim and Christian, we don't have to be too dogmatic saying, oh no, these are the zimmi people, they have to give jizya an yadin wa hum saghirun, with the interpretation that was explained earlier. It was very erroneous what saghirun really means. So I think once we look in the jizya in the proper context, it would be even more than my...
One final last question. This is oral tradition at its best,
right? One is a short comment, and actually the other one may be a short comment, but I'd like them just to respond. First, with regards to the issues, for example, what's going on in Bosnia and the Gulf War, going back a few years to the Gulf War, I should say clearly that in our community we worked with a number of Christian groups, and they were quite active in opposing the war. We were invited to a variety of churches from different denominations, and the empathy that they felt and the anger and fear and everything that was inside of them was, I think, something similar to that experienced by Muslims. And I would even go so far as to say some of them were working so hard against the war that they put many Muslims to shame by their works. So I think that should be made clear. And I think that even now there are people who are doing that. The problem with that is that it didn't translate into public action, that although there were people in the churches who were quite involved. It didn't translate into the community. And, of course, the concerns that it raised was why weren't the religious communities able to do something about it? And in other words, why did the religious communities fail to achieve the objectives of convincing their co-religionists, of their followers, to do something by not going to war or by, for example, lifting the arms embargo or something to that effect? And that became a big issue. And, of course, that's something that I cannot answer. I think that, especially in this country, a lot of the Christian communities are questioning that themselves. Why, when there's an issue that needs to be raised, what can be done about that? And that gets to the second comment, and that's about that Christians and others, the co-religions in the United States, Christians in the Middle East, are concerned about the survival of Christianity in, let's say, the Middle East. And as Muslims, I guess we find that to be a little bit strange because Christianity has survived throughout the period of Islam. And although there are these radicals that come out with erroneous statements, still the tradition of Islam has been very tolerant. And I think that the problem of Christians and Muslims and others is not an Islamic state or anything like that, but secularism. For example, in the United States, what's causing problems for everyone is the fact that religion has been completely separated from our lives. In terms of, and it's not just in terms of the war, but in terms of, for example, birth control, in terms of teenage pregnancies, drugs. Where is the religious community, and where is their effect on the community? Why are these problems afflicting our societies when we have churches and we have different communities who can participate and who can say and do something? And I think that if you compare that to the Muslim world, where you're living under Islamic rules, Muslims are living under Islamic rules, Christians will be living under their own rules. And that is actually preserving Christianity, and it's preserving Christianity in its pristine form and not watering it down to kind of figure in with some secular laws and so on. And if you could just comment on that.
I heard a question there. Yes. There.
I could also speak about Haraj if you would like, but maybe that's another minute. No, I think that's an important question. I would like to, it's probably too late to open this question, and I guess I won't open it, but just make a comment about secularism. Because I think we mean different things when we say secularism. I think there is a secularism that is an ism, which is a belief in the secular. I mean, it is the belief that religion really ought to be banished into its own little corner and maybe visited with respect periodically, but shouldn't be taken seriously. And I think that's the kind of secularism you were referring to. And I think that is an affliction that both of us, if we speak of Muslim and Christian sides, that we both face. And it may account for that phenomenon of why it is that the churches were not able to translate their principled opposition to the war into effective political action because of the belief that the churches, in some places, that the churches shouldn't get involved in such things. Right? But I think that there is another way to look at secularism, and I haven't found another word, but maybe that it ought to be secularism one and secularism two, which is that secularism, when it works well, does not discourage religion, but provides a place where different communities can witness to their belief without fear of having their rights violated by others. Because I think it's not the absence of values, but it provides a full opportunity for values to be expressed and for those values to be discussed within the society. I'm afraid that secularism one has prevailed, but secularism two is up to us in this society to bring to witness. Both sometimes sometimes we disagree with each other. In what we believe, we had some disagreements this morning.
and this afternoon, I would guess. But also that there are a lot of things that we agree on. And we ought to be able to witness together to those things that we agree on within the secular environment.
I would like to have a very brief comment on the first part of the question, which was related to making an alliance with peace-loving individuals, church groups, and others at the time of the Gulf War. And the comments that Ms. Jean, who left earlier, had about American military involvement elsewhere in the world and the atrocities that it brings about reminds me on a little bit of a lighter note of a bumper sticker that I have read once that said, "Join the army, go to exotic places, meet exciting people, and kill them." But to a large extent, that is funny yet revealing. Colliding or making an alliance with others for Muslims is definitely a positive step that is part and parcel of the teachings of Islam in terms of things that we commonly agree on, especially for the common good of the society. However, when you refer to why the religious community in the West or maybe in America did not do as much to fight this, that, and the other, seems like we lump sum the religious community in one category, and I don't think it's absolutely correct. There is some correctness to it, but however, there is also divisiveness within the religious community, even the Christian religious community in the West. We know at least for a fact that Billy Graham was almost on a daily basis with George Bush at the time of the Gulf War, encouraging him, supporting him, strengthening him, even to the very last day of his presidency. Billy Graham is not just a person, he represents an entire religious community in the West. So a lot of factors come to play and must also be taken in consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's 8 o'clock. There is a play going on about the rape of the Bosnian women. Several of the students have sort of written their own play, which is a strong protest against it. So if you'd like to go to the auditorium and see the play, they would be delighted to have you. Let me just end with a comment from a rabbi of all folks. In Jeremiah, God says that the day will come when he will put his word on the hearts of people. And the student asked the rabbi, "Rabbi, why did God say on the hearts and not in the hearts?" And the rabbi said, "My son, that's so that when the heart is broken, the word of God can enter." There are many things, of course, that break the heart, that open the heart. There are other things that harden the heart, make the heart like stone so that maybe the word of God will never drop in. And wars can do that. Prejudice can do that. All kinds of things can harden the heart, not just against each other, but even against the word of God. But other things can open the heart and maybe even break the heart in a good way. And I think that what we did today and what we attempted to do anyway, and the sharing that we've done this evening, the openness, the frankness, the kind of vulnerability of each to the other is one way of opening our hearts to each other. There's a lot of pain and it's shared. It's not just all on one side or the other. And let's hope that out of it, as our hearts open to each other a little bit, that perhaps the Word of God, however we understand it, will come in and make sometimes these hearts of stone and flint, hearts filled with bitterness, anger, frustration, all the emotions that are just represented right here in this room. Perhaps take all of them and somehow transform them into something more resembling God's will, more resembling God's mercy, more resembling God's love and grace. Thank you very much for your patience, for coming, and thank you to Hamid al-Ghazali and Muhammad Sadiq and so many others and all the participants who came and gave their time so freely, so fully, so richly. We thank you all. We have all been blessed. May you go in peace. May all of us serve the Lord.
Thank you, George. Can I suggest something that we respect 1 minute quiet time for the victims in Bosnia, and we pray for those who are alive in our own minds and hearts. Thank you.
Okay, let's stand. Let's do that, yes. Okay.
Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayers.